You are Locked On Jazz, your daily podcast on the Utah Jazz.
Part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
It is Locked On Jazz for the 15th of May. Ricky Rubio season player breakdown, a look at game one of the Western Conference Finals and the Warriors' domination of the Rockets. And it's a Time Machine Tuesday. We go back in Jazz history. It's all coming up on today's edition of Locked On Jazz. Pow! How are you? I'm David Locke, radio voice of the Utah Jazz, Jazz NBA insider. This is Locked On Jazz, your daily podcast on the Utah Jazz, giving you insight, expertise, a look behind the curtains, and a lot of geeky numbers on what's going on with the Jazz and the NBA. If you go to LockedOnJazz.net, there's a cool little feature now where you can sign up for a daily email to come to you with all the latest news on the Jazz. It includes things other than all the things I've written. So it includes some of the other news around the NBA on the Jazz. Strongly suggest it, so thank you very much for doing that. Remember, Locked On Jazz as well as LockedOnJazz.net as well as LockedOnSports.com, your spots for all the information. All right, we'll start our player breakdowns. Let's look at Ricky Rubio and the season. So there's some really interesting things on Rubio where there's a tremendous amount of growth. If you look at his usage rate, it's up to the highest rate he had in any year other than his second in the NBA. He's in the 60th percentile thinking to cleaning the glass for these numbers. Second 60th percentile of point guards. His points per shot attempt are the best they ever were in his NBA career. 63rd percentile of point guards by position. His assist rate is way down. He was in the 90th percentile every single year. He's down to the 67th. That's somewhat of how we do things and how he plays. And his assist usage ratio is way down. His turnover rate, interestingly enough, is down. It felt like it was way up, but it's actually down to the 20th percentile, which is not good. So he's dropped. He was in turned the ball over more than he had at any other point. So it's an interesting thing. His assists went down, his usage went up, and yet he was turning the ball over more. We probably have to look at it a little bit at different types and times of the season. If we look at his shooting, what an incredible uptick from his work this year. In the past years, he was in the 13th percentile, 12th percentile, 6th percentile, 10th percentile, 17th percentile. I mean, really like a failing student, right? 90th percentile is the best, and you can think about that as your grade system. So this year, he's 55th percentile in effective field goal percentage. So he was actually, for a point guard, kind of an average NBA shooter. His two-point percentage was in the 43rd percentile. His three-point shooting was in the 52nd. So when you look at Rubio's year, kind of going through, and give you all these geeky numbers, I do try to kind of give you the block, boldhead statement of what they mean. So his usage rate was way up. His points per scoring attempt way up. So he became average. What's interesting on how often the player was assisted on their made shots, he's one of the lowest rates in the NBA, so he's still not getting a lot off of his teammates. His assisted mid-range is in the 20th percentile. It always has been low. He actually was the lowest in the rate in the league at one point in time. And his assisted three-point shots are actually very, very low. So it's a little surprising to see some of that. Now, what kind of shots is he taking? And this is what's interesting on him. Even he's taking this incredible jump in his effective field goal percentage. His rim shooting is still very low and very poor. And that is going to be the huge issue for him moving on. He takes one of the highest rates of long mid-range shots, long twos, the bad shot in the league. So, which is not great. He is making them at an above-average rate. He's an overall above-average point guard shooter, but he's in the 80th percentile of taking mid-range shots and 89th on long twos. So he's going to take a ton of mid-range shots. Now, you're going to have to decide if you think everyone's protecting the rim, protecting the three. Does that shot have value again? It's really, here's the easiest way to think about it. Free throw attempts are 1.4 points per shot attempt. Restricted areas 1.3, corner threes 1.2, above the break is 1.1, and then mid-range shots are 0.8. So 1.4, 1.3, 1.2, 1.1. Makes it very easy to just kind of walk down the list. 1.4 free throws, 1.3 restricted, 1.2 corner, 1.1 above the break. So 1.4, 1.3, 1.2, 1.1. And then you drop all the way to 0.8 for mid-range shots. That's simplifying it a little bit, but it's pretty close. His corner three attempts were way up with the Jazz. His non-corner three attempts were up other than 2 years ago when he bombed quite a bit. He was actually a 37% corner three shooter, which for a point guard is average. His non-corner threes, he was 35%, which for a point guard is average. So his shooting, interestingly, is kind of average everywhere but the rim, where he's in the 24th percentile at the rim. This is still a huge part of what he has to do. He's an above average two shooter, above average long mid-range shooter. He's an average three-point shooter, and we'll dig into a little deeper of that. He did not draw fouls at the same rate he had, and that's the key thing. His shooting foul percentage, the percentage of player shots attempted where he was fouled, was down to 41 percentile, where in the years prior, he was in the 78th and 86th percentile. I don't know if it's system or something about him, but he went way down in the amount he was fouled. And that's we'll get to that. Actually, let's get to it now. His pack is below average. He's still a below average negative 0.5 pack player. And it's largely because he didn't go to the line as much. A year ago, he was negative 0.3, went to the line 13% of his possessions. Last year, he went 9.7. So while his shooting improved and he became almost average in a lot of areas, he struggled. He did not go to the line as much, and that made him a less good offensive player, actually, or less efficient. He is really a great rebounder. He's in the 93rd percentile in defensive rebounding and the 60th percentile in offensive rebounding for point guards. I like cleaning the glass because they put it to the position. Here's what I think is interesting about him. There are point guards in the NBA, Steph Curry, Dame Lillard, Chris Paul, Kyle Lowry are kind of in one class. Darren Collison is surprisingly close and underrated every year. Then you get into this next class, which is good offensive point guards. Eric Bledsoe, Kemba Walker, Drew Holiday had a great year. He also shot like 60% on mid-range shots. George Hill, DeLon Wright in Toronto, who I'm just a huge fan of. Now that's it. Like, that's it for above average offensive point guards. Now you get into this next tier, which is guys like Rubio, Elfrid Payton, Goran Dragic last year, surprisingly. Ricky Rubio, Sean Livingston, who are all negative. And then you drop to the next tier, Rajon Rondo. Then you drop to the next tier, which is the guys who are using just a ton of possessions inefficiently. So Derrick Rose, Corey Joseph, Raymond Felton, Reggie Jackson, Mike Conley was bad this year. D'Angelo Russell's minus 1.4. Reggie Jackson's a minus 1.1. John Wall's a minus 1.5. Dennis Schroeder's a minus 1.5. Russell Westbrook, minus 1. Those guys are really hurting you offensively. Ricky's not helping because he's not going to the line, but it's not as dramatic. He's really middle of the pack, maybe slightly below middle of the pack offensively. And then what you have is he's an elite rebounding player. It feels like he's a creator. I'm not sure that's true. He's an elite steals guy. He's a low foul guy. And so there's a lot of other values he brings. Looking is left corner, digging into some other numbers, left corner three is far better than his right corner three. He hit the corner three great since in the second half of the season. He was 10 of 21 after the All-Star break. This is really the note on him. Wide open three-point shooter, 37%. Guarded, 27%. Okay? So he is not going to make guarded shots. He is a open shooter, is being left open, and now has become average at making those shots. It's pretty interesting. Goes off the pick 88% of the time, high usage rate in the first quarters. That's kind of Ricky Rubio. He's got another year on his contract, and then there's the intangibles. Seems to be the heart and soul of the team, seems to give every little ounce of gusto he does, desire to win is through the roof. You have a slightly below average offensive point guard who's an elite level rebounder, which is important. Boy, he gets a lot of loose balls. He's an elite level steals guy who is improving. Now, what gets interesting here is Igor Kokoschkov leaving. So he'll probably move to work with Lamar Skeeter more, which is, you know, Lamar's great, but it's different. And it's probably a blow to Ricky because it just is another coach in another time. By the way, defensively, he was ranked this last year as the fifth best point guard defensively in the NBA. So put that whole piece together. Improving shooter, who is average shooter, below average of the rim, so he becomes a below average offensive player. If he goes to the free throw line a little bit more, he'd be average again. Who's an elite defense, elite rebounder, elite steal guy, and elite defensively. Pretty good combination of player to have on your team. Pretty strong. And then you add the fact that he's the guy who takes everyone out for dinner, is the heart and soul, and all those kind of things. Pretty nice. That, my friends, is your Ricky Rubio player breakdown for the 2018 season. Thanks to cleaningtheglass.com, Ben Falk, for a lot of those numbers. Tuesday edition of the show brought to you by my friends over at Murdoch Hyundai. Have you seen the Kona? The Kona's nice. So I'm driving the Kona right now. It is the best way. It's that small mini SUV. I don't know if you've heard about this, but like people aren't making sedans anymore. Like everyone's doing the SUV. So this is the small, hey, I want a small car. I was emailing back and forth with a listener who wanted to know about it. And I said, you know, it is small. He said, yeah, that's what I want. Golf clubs do fit across the back of it. They're cool. They're $20,000. They're getting about 30 miles to the gallon. They're zippy. Really, I'm impressed by it immensely. It's another moment of being impressed by the Hyundai. So if you're looking for that, it's really the Subaru Crosstrek. Check it out. It's the Hyundai Kona. I'm looking on their website right now at MurdochHyundai.com. One of them's at $20,000, another's at $22,000, depending on the features, another's at $23,000. You got the price point. You just got to figure out what you want. Incredible value for that. In fact, nothing down right now on the Hyundai Kona if you buy it right now. They also have got a fun SUV road trip for the summer family thing where if you buy a car right now this month, you get a free DNA test. Check it out. It's the Hyundai. You get the 100,000-mile Hyundai Assurance as well as the Murdoch Guarantee where you get car washes, safety inspections for life, price match guarantee, and say hi to Blake down there at 4646 South State Street. Jason Creech helped us out buying our car. Really good people and super impressed by the brand and my experiences so far with Hyundai. All right, let's look at game one. I wrote up a piece on Locked On Jazz about game one of the Warriors and Rockets last night. It was great. I mean, it was great. Those two teams are way better than everyone else. Okay? Right? Like, I think we've got to get that. Like, I got, you know, somebody, I saw a buddy of mine on the driving range yesterday, and he was like, it's pretty awesome to be one of those final teams. What do we do next year? And I was like, you know, like we can do a lot next year and still not be better than the Rockets and the Warriors. These two teams are just awesome. Some interesting numbers on that game. The Rockets actually shot better. The Rockets actually had better shot quality. The Warriors just shot better. It became an isolation game. The Rockets had 45 isolation attempts. Golden State had 29, which is a lot. The Rockets were actually better in isolation than the Warriors. So for all the Chris, it's stunning. Chris Webber is stunning to me. And Reggie Miller's stunning. It just makes, I have such pride in how we prepare broadcasts. And how accurate we are. The isolation game that was being criticized so much is who they are, and actually was good. Like, they're killing James Harden for it. He was 1.4 points per isolation. Chris Paul was not good last night. Eric Gordon was good, and we talked about how Klay Thompson's not good in isolation, and he only had two all night. What gets interesting is the defensive stuff. The amount of times people were hunting guys out. Kevon Looney got caught in 17. Steph Curry got caught in 15. Harden got torched in the 10 he was in. Nene, for all the talk there, was great. They only scored in 1 of 5 possessions against Nene, I think. But there were, David West got hunted out, and they scored on every possession. They couldn't play David West. Ryan Anderson, David West are problems for the rest of the series for both teams. Nene might be fine. I talked about that in the in my breakdown of that. But that was a great, great basketball game. But it's an interesting thing to watch. Like, some of the things that we talked about coming in I thought were really true. So during the regular season, the Warriors were the number one, and I find this just fascinating when these things match up. And this maybe is just that I'm too geeky, but off-ball screens, the Warriors were the number one off-ball screening team in the NBA. They off-ball screened, I'm on defense here. So the Rockets defensively only allowed 68 off-ball screens a game. They were the number one defensive team, and they allowed the fewest. The Warriors ran per game 96 off-ball screens and were the best in the league at it. Or one of the best in the league at it. So this was on off-ball screens. The Warriors were the number one off-ball screening team in the league and ran the most. The Rockets were the number one defensive team in the league and allowed the fewest. So what happened in game one? Like, I find that really kind of an interesting matchup. What I thought I saw was that the Warriors couldn't get any. Let's see. Somehow I am not getting an answer. Here we go. So the Warriors actually ran, instead of their 96, the Warriors ran 72 off-ball screens. Okay, so that's down to where the Rockets keep it. They also, though, scored on them, 1.13 points per off-ball screen. I didn't see that many. I don't know how they define these things. The Rockets ran very few and had great success, but the Rockets don't run a lot. A little bit of how I feel about Game 1 is a little bit how I felt about the Jazz and some of the things that they did early in the Rockets, maybe after Game 3 of the Rockets series, or even after Game 2, where we were doing everything we wanted to do to the Rockets. We were forcing them off the three-point line. We were forcing them off the restricted area. We were making them play a game they didn't want to. But we couldn't beat them. Like, you could just tell we weren't going to beat them. It's a little bit of how I feel like the Rockets are with the Warriors. They got them off their off-ball screen game. They forced them into an isolation game. And then the Warriors are too good. The Harden fatigue factor in isolation, I think, is an interesting discussion. But I really feel, and I get that every commentator has their personal like of how they want to watch the game. And the Rockets are just hunting out guys trying to go get them. And that's how they play. And maybe there's some legitimate argument that that's not the right way to play, but it works for them all season long. So I have a hard time with everyone criticizing what they're doing. What's interesting is the Rockets got no transition. So if you recall, during our series, we ran through a few numbers on when the Rockets lose. Do you recall that? That was one of the things we talked about a lot. And when do the Rockets lose? So let's look at what happened last night to when the Rockets lose. The Rockets' pace had no influence on their performance. 10 of their 17 losses in the regular season came when they had less than 10 fast break points. They got 3 last night. So they're not getting out in transition at all, which then makes it look like they're in the half court far more than they were otherwise. Okay, that's number one. Number two is 13 of their 17 losses, they had 14 or fewer three-point attempts. Well, last night they had 13. or makes. The magic number is if the opponent hits more than 14 and they make less than 14, they don't win. Last night they had 13. So they're a little off. But last night their offensive rating was a 108. So for all the discussion you're going to hear for the next 48 hours about isolation this and isolation that, fact is their offensive rating was a 108 last night. They got better shot quality, according to Second Spectrum, than the Warriors got. And almost all of their possessions were in the half court. The Warriors shot out of this world. 52%, 13 to 33 from three, an effective field goal percentage of 61%. Their offensive rating was a 121. Now, maybe the Rockets should be very, very concerned that someone did that to them. But a quick scan of the Rockets' worst defensive nights of the year, Minnesota put up a 122.6 against them in the game in which they lost in the playoffs. That was their 87th. So the Rockets have played 82 games, then five against each of their last two opponents. So they've played 92 games. They've only had a worst defensive night on like three occasions all year. Toronto put up a 123 against them. The Clippers put up a 123 against them. They lost those games. The Warriors on opening night put up a 121. That should be a little concerning. The Warriors put up a 121 against them when they lost to them on January 4th. That should be a little concerning. The Brooklyn Nets put up a 120 against them in a game which they actually beat the Nets. The Nets went bananas shooting. And the Minnesota Timberwolves put up a 123, which is one of Minnesota. You know, Minnesota's one of the great offensive teams. And the Portland Trailblazers did on back-to-back nights in March. And the Rockets actually won both those games. So a little bit of how I feel is the Warriors were totally dominant. The mantra you're hearing from everybody right now is if you're the Rockets, you have to be really depressed. I'm not as convinced of that. The Warriors had an incredible shooting night. The Rockets got better shots. The Rockets scored at a pretty good rate. I thought Chris Paul was terrible, and maybe he'll continue to be terrible, and probably the Warriors have too much firepower. But there's also a lot of parts of this where I didn't think this was nearly, I don't know, the ball goes in some nights, right? We've talked about this a lot. So when you dig down to the next level of statistics, this doesn't look as much of a whitewash as everyone's saying. We'll see. I mean, I picked the Warriors, and I thought the key to the entire series was that the Warriors' transition would just be too good. Right? So the Warriors ran 100%, 100 possessions more than anyone else in the NBA last year in transition. Or this year. And the Rockets' transition defense is bad. And the Warriors got 17 transition opportunities and averaged 1.5 points per transition opportunity. That's incredible. That was the game. For the season, the Warriors were the best transition team in the NBA the Rockets were actually. The Warriors were fourth best at 1.3. The problem is the Rockets were not. They're 23rd in the league defensively in transition. And they allowed 1.3. So they're bad defensively in transition. And that's their Achilles heel. And my feeling was that that would be the item that was too big a deal for this series. And that was right in game one. If they fix that and they play better transition defense, things equal out a little bit. And frankly, what's worth digging into, and I don't know if Cleaning the Glass has this, I haven't figured, they do great stuff, is what were the Rockets defensively in half court? Because the Rockets in half court are the second best, after a make, are the second best defense in the league. And I don't know whether or not you take out that 1.5 points per possession in a 100-possession game, whether you're suddenly going to see that the Rockets are much here it is in half court. Now the Warriors were still pretty awesome, but in transition they were great. They were great, and so that was a huge part of that game. Rad Concrete Coating. He says slowly so he doesn't screw up the name again. Rad Concrete Coating is a Utah-based company run by Mike and the crew. They opened up 17 years ago, and they still have their first employee on staff, which is cool. They are there for you for waterproof deck coatings, garage floor coatings, even waterproofing an entire garage. Concrete overlays, driveway resurfacing, we know about the salt death, harsh winters, surface, all that kind of stuff. If you go to radutah.com or radconcretecoatings.com, you will see the incredible pictures. You'll see them at Tour of Homes. If you go out to Tour of Homes, you will see Rad Concrete Coating because they do the best stuff there is. They are actually in 8 of the homes in the Utah County, parade of homes. But if you go to Rad Concrete Coatings, you'll see what they have done. Great, unbelievable looking garages. I'm kind of wishing we had known about it before. Super color samples. They go to the World of Concrete every year to get you the best opportunities, and they have the best applicators around. The driveways on their pictures are just amazing. Go to the website, enter in a bid, and see what they can do for you. Waterproof deck coatings, concrete polishing, garage floor coatings that are just great. Really, absolutely looks fabulous in all of these pictures that they've done. Check it out, radconcretecoating.com or radutah.com. All right, let's do Time Machine Tuesday. He reaches into his bag, pulls up a year. It's got to be a playoff year. I will admit, I've gone through the bag and eliminated non-playoff years because it would be no fun to pull out a playoff year. Ooh, 1986-87. I don't think we did great that year. Frank Layden's still the head coach. Let's look at what we're doing. I don't know if we're still alive on May 15th. This I might have to pull another one out. We ended on May 3rd brutal. Brutal moment in Jazz history. We'll talk about this. We'll use this as we'll go back. We're struggling to come back from this. So this was a 5-game series against the Warriors in 87. We were kind of rolling that year. We were at 44-35 and then lost our final three. Started the year at 19-9, thought we were really cooking, and then kind of played below 500 ball for the rest of the year. On a team that was 86-87, your leading scorer that year was Karl Malone as a 23-year-old, followed by Daryl Griffith at 15 a game, Thurl Bailey, Kelly Tripucka, Bobby Hanson, Ricky Green. John Stockton was at 24 years old, Mark Eaton. Your starting five that year was Ricky Green, with Stockton coming off the bench. Can you imagine the outrage? We didn't know. Ricky Green, Bobby Hanson, Kelly Tripucka, Daryl Griffith, and Karl Malone. So Malone's your four. We are the number one defensive team in the league, 21st in the league offensively, 3rd in pace of play. It's interesting. It's hard to be. We took 6% of our shots as threes. It was the 7th highest rate in the NBA. That's incredible. Frank was like ahead of his time. 6%. But so here's the tragedy. So we have this start of the year. We think we're pretty good. And then we go to the playoffs at 44-38 scuffling and win the first two against the Warriors. So like we're like, oh, we're back on. 99-85 in game one. The Jazz win it at home. Warriors can't score. They have Joe Barry Carroll, Chris Mullin, Sleepy Floyd, Larry Smith, Purvis Short, who I met the other day and was totally excited. Mailman drops 20 in game one. Thurl Bailey comes off the bench for 20. Stockton plays 9 minutes that night. 9 minutes off the bench. Ricky Green had 15 points, 15 assists, and 6 rebounds. Game two, Barn burner, win it 103-100 or up early big, up 17 at the half, then got outscored 30-15 in the third quarter, held on to win it. Joe Barry Carroll gets going in that game. He has 22, but he fouls out. 22 for the mailman on 6 of 18 shooting. Stockton plays 27 minutes in this game, but scores just 4 points on 1 of 3 shooting. Frank Layden really goes to the bench here. Bailey has 11. Daryl Griffith comes off the bench for 25. We go to Golden State in game 3 and get blasted. 110-95. We're down by 12 by halftime and run out of the gym in the fourth quarter. Mailman has 15, but he's having a brutal series. He's 6 of 15 shooting again. Ricky Green plays 15 minutes. John Stockton plays 30. This is the Stockton coming out party series. 13 points, 8 assists. Big T comes off the bench for 14. Daryl Griffith goes 4 of 17, and the Jazz lose. So we go to game 4, back still in Oakland. John Stockton now starts. Ricky Green's injured, does not play. Stockton plays 45 minutes, scores 15 points, 11 assists, 6 steals. Eaton plays 45 minutes, has 15 boards. The mailman has a better night, goes 8 of 19, still struggling at the line. Bobby Hansen has 20. Thurl has 14, but the Jazz lose it 98-94 when they lead by 6 going to the fourth. And the Warriors come back, outscore the Jazz 98-94 in that fourth quarter. Sleepy Floyd had 22, 18 for Chris Mullin, and Purvis Short came off the bench for 32. So we go to a best-of-five series on Sunday at Salt Lake City, a Sunday game in 1987 at home against the Warriors. Both offenses are unbelievable. The offensive rating for the Warriors was a 127. For the Jazz was a 122. John Stockton gets the start again, plays 46, has 14 points, 13 assists, 3 steals. So Ricky Green's injury, Ricky Green plays then 2 minutes in that game. And this is kind of the Stockton coming out party. It's now Stockton's team. It's kind of an important series in Jazz history. Mailman has 23, goes 7-11 from the line. But the Jazz, Thurl Bailey plays 33. Guys are playing. Sleepy Floyd plays 44, scores 21. Joe Barry Carroll has 24, fouls out again. Purvis Short off the bench with 14. Late Greg Ballard had 18 and 11. The Jazz got blown out early. They were down 6 at the end of 1 and then down 16 at the half in game 5 at home and end up losing the series, losing 3 straight to the Warriors in May 3rd of 1987. But kind of what's important in regards to the Jazz is then by the time you get to the 87-88 team, that's when the Jazz then have their great run against the Lakers after beating Portland in the first round. But more importantly, that's the series where then John Stockton takes over. Ricky Green's on the team the next year. He only starts 3 games all year. Stockton becomes 35-minute-a-night. Stockton averages 14 assists. And so this is the series in which John Stockton comes through and takes over the Utah Jazz. That is your edition of Locked On Jazz and Time Machine Tuesday. Thanks very much for tuning in today. Greatly appreciate it. It is Locked On Jazz, part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Go to lockedonjazz.net for all your latest information.